Est-ce que tout le monde entendait?
Ouais.
Ça va? Vous avez le micro?
Alors, un sujet. Est-ce qu'il y a des gens qui ne comprennent pas du tout l'anglais et qui souhaitent avoir une traduction? Parce que... on peut mettre un traducteur dans un coin avec les gens qui souhaitent. Au coin, on
qui a besoin de traduction? Tu vas attendre.
Mais il y a quelqu'un
ici.
Rosario, la compagnie.
Yeah, no, I understand, yeah. That's fine. Think of something to say. Anytime. That's it? Okay. What about the lengthy introductions about all my accomplishments?
I will. Because it goes without saying.
It goes without saying.
No. So I will introduce Norman.
That's right. Proper introduction.
Donc, il faut le micro, c'est ça? Oui. Ok. Donc, je vais faire l'introduction brève de Norman. Que moi j'ai rencontré parce qu'on est tous les deux poètes. Ça se trouve qu'on est tous les deux poètes et on est tous les deux dans cette truc zen. Et il n'y en a pas tant que gens que ça. Hein. There aren't so many people who do what we do, right?
Right, poets, not too many. Right. Five maybe.
Yes.
And one of them is Leonard Cohen.
That's right.
Donc. Quand j'ai rencontré Norman, tout de suite, enfin, ça fait des années que je connaissais son poésie, mais je l'ai rencontré, et on s'est sympathisé, et on s'est dit que quand il vient à Paris, il peut donner un discours pour nous. Et c'est ce qu'il fait, ça tombe ce soir où on fait l'inauguration. Norman était l'ancienne, il a fait depuis des années, je ne sais même pas quelle année il a commencé, à faire le zen, in the 70s you probably started?
That's
what
I think.
Yeah. À Berkeley, et puis San Francisco, dans le grand lieu de Suzuki Roshi. Et puis, il est devenu prêtre, il était ordonné, et puis il a reçu la transmission de Dharma, de Shio, et il était l'abbé du centre zen de San Francisco pendant
5 years, you were there, Abby?
Pendant 5 ans, il était l'abbé de San Francisco Zen Center. Sa femme est aussi avec nous ce soir, Cathy, je ne vois pas où c'est. Cathy is here as well. Elle est aussi un successeur du Dharma et ils sont là ensemble, ils étaient ailleurs en France avant. Je ne sais pas ce que je peux dire d'autre. Il va nous parler des choses, il a écrit des livres, il est très, il a Everyday Zen Foundation, qui est une fondation où ils n'ont pas un lieu, c'est un peu comme moi, je faisais pendant des années, sans lieu, et il va nous parler un peu de ça, j'aimerais aussi
Okay, I was kidding about the long introduction.
But you were right. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. It's wonderful to see so many of you here, and I'm really, really very, very happy to be here and to see all of you here, because I have a tremendous faith in Amy. I think Amy's great. She's a wonderful teacher. And I also have tremendous faith in this practice. It's a good practice. It's pretty simple and straightforward, despite those of you who might not be used to the chanting and all that, it might have seemed overly elaborate to you, but actually it's very simple and straightforward practice, and transformative, changes your life for the better, and I think we need it, right? I don't know what happened, but the world has become crazy and difficult. Have you noticed this? Probably. You wouldn't be here if you didn't notice. In many ways, of course, we've improved things so much. And the things we can do and the ways we can help each other, it's brilliant, it's wonderful. But at the same time, we haven't really learned how to love each other. We haven't really learned how to be thoughtful and sensible about how we live. We haven't learned how to take care of the planet. And we seem to persist in the most destructive sorts of behaviors. And everybody who goes to work every day can't help but notice this. Can't help but feel the stress and the strain involved in living in a world that looks pretty good on the outside and works really well in many ways, but in other ways doesn't work at all. And everybody knows it. And nobody really can talk about it. And it's sad and it's painful for all of us, and we need to help each other, and we need something to help us to have the capacity to see things as they really are and not kid ourselves about our problems, and at the same time not think that they're so overwhelming that we can't even deal with them. We can, and we can face our own suffering and be transformed. And I think nothing will help more in that. Closer to the mouth for the mic, yeah. Are we doing okay for hearing? Everybody's hearing? And yes? Tell me if you're not. Yes, okay. So anyway, there's a lot of ways to do Zen practice or spiritual practice. It doesn't, obviously, not everybody in the world has to do Zen practice or Buddhist practice. But I actually do think that everybody in the world does have to do some kind of spiritual practice, some way to stay in touch with our hearts. And Zen practice really helps with that. It just so happens, I mean, I was coming to town because I had some business in France, and I was coming to Paris to visit our dear niece Hannah and her family, and Hannah's here tonight. I don't know where she is. I can't see her face. There you are. Yeah. So we wanted to come and see Hannah, and then we wanted to come to Paris, and we had a poetry reading the other night, and I said to Amy, well, how about I come over and give a talk? It happened to be this week, and it just so happens that it coincided with the opening of this center. And it just so happened that that coincides with the closing of the Paris Bureau of the New York Times, where Amy has worked for 30-some years. So now Amy has nothing else to do but take care of all of you who are coming here to practice Zen. And I think that's wonderful, because this is exactly the moment when that's needed and when her considerable talents will be challenged and maximized. So that's brilliant. So it's an odd thing, and always important and always interesting when
something important from one culture gets transferred to another culture. The history of civilization is full of these transferences, right? From the very beginning, of course, people in one place would develop a way of life, people in another place would develop a different way of life. They would meet, they would share ideas, and everybody would be changed in the process. And so that's something that's been going on in a really important way in our time as Buddhism travels from Eastern cultures to Western cultures. It's been going on now for some time. And it's been really transformative of Western culture and also transformative of Buddhism. I think probably if we were to think about all the ways in which Buddhism has changed Western culture, we would be surprised at how many ways that we didn't even realize had their source in Buddhist thought and Buddhist ideas that have now become incorporated into our culture, including the entire mindfulness movement, which everybody knows about now, and has mindfulness has influenced business and the arts and the sciences and everything. But many other aspects of Western thought have been altered by the encounter with Buddhism, and Buddhism itself has been altered by the encounter with the West. Buddhists now in Asia are much more socially concerned than they used to be. Social concern is really a Western idea, more than an Eastern idea. And in many other ways, Buddhism in Asia has been transformed. And this process of mutual influence and transformation has been going on continuously and still going on. And every day, we're learning more and changing a little bit more. And I think it's a change that will really be good because it will really help all of us on the planet to become more flexible in our viewpoints and more compassionate in the way that we treat one another and see our own lives. But that's important not only on a big societal scale, but it's important to every one of us as individuals because, you know, although we think of ourselves as being just me, we're not just me, right? Nobody's just me. You exist as it does because you have been influenced by everything around you. You wouldn't be you, right, if your family didn't teach you French and a way of living and an understanding of the world, if you didn't live in a contemporary culture with all the things that you've learned that have been incorporated into the person that you are. So in other words, when these cultural transferences occur, it changes every person. Every person becomes different. Because I think we all have the idea that we are who we are and that's that. But it isn't that. We are who we are and we're all radically in process. Everybody here knows that you are a different person, literally a different person from the person you were 20 years ago, 30 years ago. You are not that person anymore. You're a different person now because of all that's happened in that time. And you'll be a different person 20 or 30 years from now if you're still around. Maybe you won't be. Then you'll really be different. So in other words, we're in process. And the question is, in what process? Are we in a process of change that we sort of stumble along with? Not really knowing what the change is or shaping it in any way or choosing it really? Or are we in a process of change that we're thoughtful about and that we participate in some way? So that's why I think all of these things that we're doing, meditating and chanting and studying Dharma, studying the teachings and words of the Buddha, all these things are really important, I think, for transforming our culture and also transforming each one of us, our lives, each one of our lives. So I've been doing this my whole life, and it's it's getting more interesting, actually, than it was 30, 40 years ago. It's getting more interesting, deeper and more interesting. And I'm really fortunate, I feel fortunate to be doing it. And Catherine and Michelle, Amy's teacher, Catherine, and her husband Michelle have been doing this for pretty much as long as I have, and so you know what I mean. So we're very fortunate, aren't we, to be stumbled into this crazy idea of doing Buddhism, not knowing any better than to realize how difficult it really is. We just stumbled into it and started doing it. But now since we were doing it, it's a lot easier and more accessible to people now. So you can stand on our shoulders. And I always think that the person who comes to study now, in 2 years, it knows what it took me about 20 years to learn and understand. So that's great. We have each other to help each other. So there are always new generations of people coming to practice, and the culture is always changing, right? So you always need new books with the title of, you know, Introduction to Zen. You think, well, if somebody already wrote a really good introduction to Zen, why would you need another one? Because every 10 years, it's all different. It's a different story. So the wise publishers of the American press, Shambhala, which publishes a lot of Buddhist material, approached me a while ago and said, would you be willing to write a new introduction for our time now to Zen Buddhism? Is the translation working? Good. I'm not talking too complicated. No. It all works. Okay, good. I was wondering, why are you people whispering the whole time I'm talking?
I'm just running with you.
You know, I teach a lot in Mexico. We have a group in Mexico, and there I speak a phrase, and my translator speaks a phrase, and I speak a phrase, and she speaks a phrase, and I speak a phrase, and she speaks a phrase. And then I could think of things to say in between while I'm waiting for her translator. Anyway, so they said, would you do this? Would you write a book about, an introductory book about Zen for our time? And I said, oh, I don't know. That sounds pretty hard. Also a little boring. You know what I mean? It's like writing a textbook. You know, whatever it is that you do, imagine writing a textbook about it. You know, and dutifully thinking about all the things that you think a person should be knowing. Doesn't that sound boring? That's kind of how it sounded to me. So I said, well, I have other writing projects to do, and I don't know. And then I thought about it for a minute, and I had this friend who's also studied Buddhism with me for a long time, who's a writer and a very lively person. And she and I had done this before. We had done a collaborative article where she interviewed me and I answered her questions in writing, and that became our article. So I said to the people at Shambhala, suppose we did this with our introduction to Zen. Sue can write questions, and I will just write the answers to her questions, and that way we'll have a good introduction to Zen book. And secretly I thought to myself, and then she'll organize the entire book by her questions, and all I have to do is respond to questions, which is easy enough. It's thinking that's hard, right? Thinking is hard. So they went for the idea, and the book came out, and it's much better than I would have ever done on my own. Much better. Because she asks all these embarrassing questions. Questions that nobody, it's kind of funny because she's been practicing Zen for 35, 40 years, and she's asking questions as if she were a beginner. But of course, she's not. So she sort of knows all the questions that really somebody should ask, but they never would ask. They never would ask, you know. So this book actually is fun because it has all these questions that are too embarrassing to ever be put in a beginner's book about Zen, and that nobody would ever ask if they ever came to a Zen center like what about scandals in Zen and are you enlightened and stuff like that. I mean, nobody would ever. But she asked all this stuff. So it's actually kind of a fun book, and there's a lot of humor in it. So what I thought I would do now is read you the first couple of pages of the book, and then I would like to stop talking and see what you have to say. Because mostly what I wanted to do is just talk enough so that you get to know me a little bit and feel that you can ask me a question that's really interesting and important to you so that I could talk to you. Because that's the most important thing, to talk to one another. So I'm going to read a few pages, and then hopefully you'll have things to say. And I'm going to read to you from the very beginning of this book. And the title of the book is the same as the title of the talk. What is Zen? Plain talk for a beginner's mind. But actually, it's a really interesting book if you're not a beginner. Because it has all these embarrassing questions in it. And things probably that you may be practicing Zen for decades always wanted to know about, but were scared to ask your teachers and other people because you thought they all knew and everything. So you might want to read it too. So the first chapter is called, What's the Point? Good question, right? What is the point of, why would you do all this? What's the point? So here's that's the chapter title, and the first question reads like this. What is Zen? The word is much bandied about. Is it an interior decorating style? Is it a way to drink tea? Does it mean simplicity? Paradox? Inscrutability? Earthenware pottery? That's the question. So here's the answer. Anyway, my answer at that moment. What is Zen? That's a good place to begin. The simple answer is that Zen is Zen Buddhism, an Asian religion now practiced all over the world. Broadly, there are three forms of Buddhism. Theravada Buddhism, which emphasizes the earliest scriptures that seem to be mostly about individual liberation. Mahayana Buddhism, which emphasizes compassion and social concern as much as or more than individual liberation. And third, Vajrayana Buddhism, which is the Buddhism of Tibet, which adds detailed esoteric ritualistic practices. So Zen is a form of Mahayana Buddhism. I'm sorry about my whatever I have, cold or sore throat or something. Zen is a form of Mahayana Buddhism developed in China about 1,500 years ago, more than a millennium after the time of the historical Buddha, and exported to Korea, Japan, and Vietnam centuries before it came to the West. In China, Mahayana Buddhism met Chinese culture to make a new form of Buddhism that was both intense and formal, and at the same time, simple, even poetic, and funny in its literary style. As many of you know, if you've read Zen stories, they're often kind of quirky and funny. Like all religions, Zen Buddhism has clergy, ritual, scripture, hierarchy, and so on. Which is why it's kind of sad, but there are so many people now who really want to practice Zen and practice meditation and even practice Buddhism, but are kind of stopped at the door by all this stuff that sounds like religion. And because of a long historical journey, and every country has their own version of this journey, in the contemporary world, religion is weird. And to many people of course are fanatic about their religion, and many other people think religion is sort of cultish and weird and irrational and not for thinking people. And so they would have a hard time showing up to a place like this. And that's too bad. But it's because Zen reads like a religion, hierarchy, clergy, and all that. Anyway, that's the simple answer to the question, what is Zen? As your question implies, the word Zen has been appropriated in our contemporary culture to stand for a whole host of ideas, some of which come from essential ideas and practices of Zen Buddhism. The word Zen implies presence, calmness, simplicity, profound acceptance, and fully living in the present moment. And these are all values implied in Zen Buddhist practice and teaching. The quintessential practice of Zen is Zazen, sitting meditation. So the word Zen also carries an aura of silence and the ineffability associated with silence. Wei Mentong, a legendary figure of ancient Chinese Zen, famously said that he had miraculous powers, and that his miraculous powers were that he carried wood and drew water. So that's Zen too, the miraculous power of paying full attention to all the activities of everyday life. So given all this, it's easy to see why the idea of Zen has become so popular and so plastic. And there's all kinds of, in the United States we have Zen breakfast cereal, we have Zen perfume, and I think people feel like they put a little perfume on and they get their Zen going, you know, they get calmer and feel better. And so I always say, I don't think that the Zen Buddhist religion has a patent on the brand of Zen. It seems like it's a free world and everybody can take it the way they want. Who am I to say they can't? The next question, and this will be the last. What's the point of Zen practice? Why would you practice Zen? Yes. Right. Good question. So Zen practice refers to the various spiritual practices of Zen Buddhism. Things like sitting meditation, retreats, attending talks, ceremonies like the one we just had. People don't like ceremonies, but actually, if you got married, you know that a ceremony can be sometimes a good idea. A lot of people in France, they tell me, don't get married, because they don't think the ceremony is worth it. You know? But if you did have a wedding ceremony, and you might have found it meaningful. Funerals are meaningful. In other words, to be able to come together and have a way of saying, this is a moment. Let's mark it together in community. That's really good. So Zen has ceremonies. Meetings with teachers, a part of Zen practice. Textual study, all the stuff that constitutes formal Zen practice. That's what Zen practice is. And yes, there's a lot to this. So why would anybody want to do all that? What is the point of doing all that? Many people come and they do it, and then they never ask necessarily, so why are we doing all this stuff? What's the point? Well, many people go to Zen places because Buddhism or meditation practice is nowadays very fashionable. All this research we have now about meditation and brain plasticity is very convincing. So maybe that's why they come. Or maybe they go because they read some intriguing, puzzling, or inspiring Zen book. Maybe they go because they think it will make them calmer, happier, more present in their lives. Maybe they go because they hope to have some amazing enlightenment experiences like the ones they had when they took drugs and things. Or maybe they just think that it's a wonderful, like a place like this is so kind of like beautiful in a way, and calm spaces to be in. It makes you feel happy to just enter a space, a simple, calm Zen space. So maybe those are reasons why. Maybe that's the point for a lot of people. But whatever the point seems to be, and whatever it looks like made you come to the Zen place, I believe actually there's another reason. There's an old saying in Zen, the fire god comes seeking fire. In other words, the Buddha in you comes seeking the Buddha in the practice, even though you might not realize this at first. And what is it that the Buddha is seeking? Let's be honest. Life is very, very difficult. Actually, to be really honest, human life is pretty much impossible. Because we all suffer. We all have a lot of suffering. Let's start with the fact that we're all going to die, and mostly we don't want to. Let's maybe start with the fact that really we are clueless about the real nature of this sad, beautiful, and immense human life that we've been gifted. And this cluelessness actually is a big problem for us. And it ends up causing us a lot of extra pain. So we all have some suffering. Everybody does. Maybe most of us have been pretty successful in putting that suffering to one side. Maybe we've been pretty good at distracting ourselves from it or denying that it really exists. But we all know that it's there in the shadows of our lives, in the background. So why do we practice? To relieve suffering. Now, this doesn't mean that Zen practice makes you immune to suffering and cheerful all the time. But Zen practice does help you to understand your suffering, understand our suffering, and to disentangle yourself from it. And even, believe it or not, come to appreciate it, the very suffering, so that now you can cope, really cope, and not only cope, but thrive, even when things don't go right, even when things are difficult. Zen practice helps us to be more present. More present with sounds and everything that's happening in the actual life that we're living. And the more present we are, the more we see through our many projected delusions and illusions and enjoy our lives, seeing our difficulties as intriguing challenges rather than pathetic failures. The truth of the matter is, being alive is a tremendous, tremendous gift and a privilege. It doesn't last that long. And it's a privilege. And it's a big responsibility, being alive in this human realm. And when you practice, when you do spiritual practice, seriously, over time, you get that point, and you are able to take on the project of being you in your life in that spirit. So I think that's why we practice Zen, even if we don't know that in the beginning. Eventually, we come to realize that. So that's what I wanted to say, and that's maybe enough. And now I would really be happy to talk to you, whatever it is. I don't mean this to be, and I hope you don't think it would be question and answer, like you're going to ask a question and I'm going to give the answer. But why don't you say something that's important to you? It could be in the form of a question or a statement or a thought, whatever it is. And if I have something to say, I'll respond to you. And maybe someone else will as well. So we can have a kind of conversation. So, what do you have to say? Yes.
No, no. When you say life is a privilege, don't you think so? We just tell ourselves that because we are afraid of death?
No,
why would life be a privilege?
I'll try to repeat in case. She said, she's questioning. Life is a privilege, really? Isn't that just something we tell ourselves because we're scared of dying? That's what she said. I suppose that could be true. That could be true. But when I say that, and I think about myself, as far as I know my motivations in saying the things that I say, I don't think that that's why I say that. I don't think so. I think that I say that because I'm aware of how, at my age, you know, time has gone by really quickly. I was a young person very recently. It seemed like, really, just like moments ago, it seems to me. So in other words, I realize that life goes by really swiftly. And I realize how precious it is and how rare it is, you know, to be a human being in this world. I think it's rare, it's precious, it's wonderful, and it's a big responsibility. So I really do think it's a privilege. And I don't think I'm saying that out of fear of dying. But you never know. One could deceive oneself, so it's possible. Yeah. But now, what do you think? Did I convince you, or are you still skeptical of this?
I think we don't know.
We don't know, yeah. That's true.
And I think it's perhaps a better practice to open to the not knowing than to tell ourselves something.
Yes.
That might convince us.
Yes.
I think that's the privilege of Zen practice for me.
Yes, she's saying that really and truly we don't know if life is a privilege, or we don't even know what the word privilege means even, right? So she's saying it's better to rest in not knowing than in a story about somehow life is a privilege as an ideology. And I think that makes a lot of sense to me, yeah. So I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I want to thank you for your eloquence.
Oh.
Yeah, like some, you know, really clear and elegant ideas.
Thank you.
But my comment or question similar to the woman who just spoke, in that you know, there's times, you said you've been practicing for as long as people have been practicing. You know, look at all these people. There's many people who are interested in Zen, these rakusus, they're like doing it. You've seen so many people rock with Susan. Those rock with Susan, like that dude you started with. Where is he now? Like, there's so many people you practice with and don't do it anymore, right?
Yeah.
And so many destinies going here and there, and times where you're not motivated. I'm sure you've turned to your partner and said, "Fuck this." Recently, maybe fuck this. You know?
Did I say that? Have I said that lately, Kathy? I don't think so. Oh, she okay, yeah.
So, you know, we go through a lot of different states of, yeah, you know, a lot of different things go on.
Right.
And I myself, when I come back to it, I don't know why I come back to it.
Yeah.
And so I'm intrigued by this thing about the fire god.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued by the it's like, you know, like a song or a slogan, like we're talking about culturally, how things, cultures clash and meet, and some idea catches on.
Yeah.
You know, we're gonna associate Apple with Gandhi's face. Yeah, we'll do that. Like some idea catches on,
yeah,
right? And maybe in our life, these, like, it's almost like you're suggesting that this vows, this aspiration, this to relieve our suffering, you know, it's got this life of its own. But so does a lot of the negative things as well. You know, when we were saying earlier, we were chanting, and it said, this is something, every time I hear it, I just can't get, you know, this thing about a don't waste your time. You know, don't waste your time. Whereas sometimes I feel like, oh my God, better not waste my time, otherwise I'm fine, I'm not wasting my time. You know, we have different states of mind. Who's to know which is the right one? Cutting through trying to have discernment about these things, but without being judgmental about oneself. Like, which is the right mind? Which is the right practice? Which is the right frame of mind?
Maybe I'll stop you there, because you said a lot of stuff there.
Well, it's one stuff I'm trying to say, but I understand.
But
similar to what you're talking about.
Right. So I'm going to try to, yeah, reduce it to the kernel of what I'm hearing you bring up, which is, life is various. Sometimes you feel like practicing Zen, sometimes you don't. You keep coming back. People come and go. It's not at all clear. What are we? Does this really work? What are we really doing? What motivates us truly to keep it up? What is it really about? How's that? Is that more or less what you're...
Not really. Let me try to say it super simple. Excuse me. You suggested that Buddha fire god, you know...
The fire god seeking Buddha, yeah.
Yeah, it's also like this...
So what is it we're seeking?
You were suggesting that this Buddha in us, and aside from all the various things we think we're doing with Zen, there's this good thing that's trying to get through.
Right.
That's how it feels when it feels good, when we're sitting with the teacher, and it's like, it's good, isn't it? Yes, it's good.
Right.
There's other times when we're not thinking that at all.
Right.
So that's what makes you think that noble idea is truer than a horrific, painful, confused idea?
Yeah.
What makes you think that the person who said, fuck this Zen shit, I'm going to psychoanalysis, y'all are completely fucked up and regressive.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God I've come to my senses. So, you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's clear that human beings have a tremendous possibility of confusion and unhappiness. Right?
Yeah.
No. And it's also true that human beings have also the possibility for really settling into a kind of true way of living that speaks to their hearts. We have all of that. So that's right. Your description, your report is exactly right. Sometimes we're pushed this way and sometimes we're pushed that way. And which of the two is true or false? It's all true, and it's all false. There's no something we say this is right and this is wrong. But we all have the job of asking ourselves for our own lives the question: what life do I want to live? What life do I want to live? And if someone says, I went to the Zen place and that's not the life I want to live. I want to live a life in psychoanalysis is my path. Or somebody else might say, I actually want to live this life of not doing any spiritual practice and I don't know what, doing a hobby or relaxing or living and dying in the way that I feel like it. It's a choice that everybody has to make. So I'm speaking from the place of being a person who has made a choice to practice in this way. And I'm talking to that part of you and everybody else in the room that has that same choice in you. Now I understand, of course, that everybody's not going to make that choice. But it's a belief of mine. I guess I would have to say it's just a faith that I have, that everybody, every human being has that choice, wants to make that choice to live a life of kindness, of compassion, of truth. I believe that that's what every human being wants. Can I prove it? Is that true? No. That's how I feel from the life that I have lived. Is everybody going to make that choice? No, not everybody's going to make that choice. We know that because we look at the world every day and we understand that most people have not made that choice. But I think that choice is there for us to make. And I feel like our lives are more beautiful and more beneficial to one another when we have made such a choice. So I'm not arguing for truth. I'm arguing for what is your life? And let's see, each one of us, what life we want to live. That's what I'm saying. Amy, I feel sorry for you. You have such tough students. How are you going to survive these students? What is going to happen? Are there other questions? How about a nice, easy question? Like, what is this thing you're wearing? How about something like that? Oh, we do? Okay. Oh, good. I'm saved. One more question. Yes. There's a hand, I see. Hi.
Not easy question.
Oh.
Related to the two that have just been asked.
Uh-huh.
So I've been studying myself and and discovering that that I have a great lack of appreciation. I find it very difficult to recognize the preciousness of life and just appreciate things in general and appreciate people. I don't like people. I don't like things happening. I don't like things happening in a way that I don't want them to go in.
And you think that that's a permanent condition that defines who you are?
Well, no, but it's there. And
how do you feel when you are with people and you don't like being with people, and when you're living in the world and you don't like what's happening, how does that make you feel?
Sad.
Yeah.
And somehow it seems to me that it should be different, and I would like it to be different. And this is where the question of choice is intriguing to me. And I had this really interesting and thought-provoking discussion this summer with someone who affirmed that there was that no one had a choice. That basically you act out of a response to various stimuli, and you don't really have a choice. And I didn't completely agree with that. I do think there is a difference between choosing to be mindful, at least, and or not. But I wonder now. I'm wondering if how deliberate that is, and how much of the power of decision one has to affect one's state of mind. And is it just watching it? Because I've been watching my mind for a while, and whether I do it very deliberately and with a lot of concentration, whether I just try and relax into it, this general lack of appreciation doesn't seem to be changing very much. And maybe there's too much expectation. Maybe I just have to accept that. But it's tremendously saddening, and I don't really know what to do about it.
Mm. Well, thank you for saying that. It's awfully it's a gift to everybody for you to be that honest and self-revealing in a big group of people. What's your name?
Finn.
Thanks for saying all that, Finn. Well, I think that you're not the only one who has that feeling. I think a lot of people, if they were to be honest enough and as courageous as you are, would have to admit that something like that is true for them as well. A moment ago, what's your name?
Michel-Ange.
Say again, please.
Michel-Ange.
Michel-Ange, yes?
Yeah.
Said a moment ago that we talked in our conversation, we talked about choice. And now you were saying, is there a choice? Right. So I think it's one of the most valuable things about spiritual practice in general, and Zen in particular, and something that has borne out to be true in my own life, so I'm speaking from my own experience, that at some point you make a vow. You realize that no ordinary choice will be strong enough, and no adjustment of your own mind or the world outside of you will be sufficient to overcome this feeling. So you make a vow. You make a vow to continue your practice, come what may. And you devote yourself to that vow. And you don't really know, there's no guarantees or any contract that says this or that will come to you if you follow this vow. And so it's a kind of a leap. But you do it. You follow that vow and you continue your practice. And my experience has been that when you do that, your mind becomes bigger. So that you can have just the feeling that you're describing, except you don't mind. And the reason you mind is because you were expecting it to be different. You were hoping it would be different. You were even hoping maybe Zen practice would make it different. But now, with your vow, it doesn't make any difference at all what state of mind you're in. If you're in a happy state of mind, you rejoice. If you're in a, you know, dull state of mind, you're just dull. If you're in an exalted state of mind, you're exalted. If your mind is angry, your mind is angry. And you're happy to have it be the way it is, because you know it'll change. And you know that every state of mind just comes and goes. And you're not expecting anything else. And when you're not expecting anything else and you're living your vow, then it's really, 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 really okay. And you even find some advantages in the mind that you're describing, because it has the advantage of being even and steady. It just keeps going on. So that, and that can be helpful sometimes. So in other words, everything that you wish wasn't there has an advantage once you accept it, and in accepting it, transform it. But that comes from vow. But vow is not something that you suddenly decide you're going to have a vow, right? Vow comes out of your practice. If you've been doing, those of you who've been doing Zen understand what I mean, that if somebody, like in our group, if somebody comes in the first day and says, I would like to make a vow to practice Zen for the rest of my life and become a priest, I usually say to them, that's a wonderful idea. Why don't you hang around for 3 to 5 years and see if you still feel that way? Because you can't decide that. It grows on you. That's the fire God seeking fire part, right? I believe, as I said a moment ago, that vow is in every single human being. That's my faith. I believe it. And whenever I meet another person, that's the person I'm talking to. That's the person I'm relating to. And that's why I have a lot of friends. Because everybody's a pretty good person, as far as I can tell. Because that's where I'm meeting that person. But it takes a while to actually uncover that person within yourself. And when you do, and when you act on that, I think it does eventually transform your life. Like I said in the piece I wrote, it doesn't mean that you're going to be cheerful and happy every minute. I myself am not the most cheerful and happy person. I'm kind of like a dark, you know, bad mood kind of, oh man, the world is hopeless type of person. But I think that's a reasonable approach. Anyway, I can't help it. That's the way I'm. So I can't change that in myself. But I don't need to. That doesn't need to like sink my boat, right? I can just say that's okay. That means that I write a certain kind of poetry that I really enjoy, and it's good. It feeds my heart. As long as I don't like get obsessed with it and start trashing my friends because I'm in a bad mood, right? So there's a way to live this that really works. I mean, I can see that. That all of your questions are coming from people who are really looking at this and not wanting to take any happy messages for granted. And maybe I'm sounding like I'm too happy a message tonight. If so, that's just what happened. I'm so overjoyed to be here on this night opening up this new center that it's clouded my mind, and I'm saying all these things that make life seem almost possible. But I did say life is impossible, didn't I, in the thing I wrote?
You said almost impossible.
Almost like impossible.
You're saying almost impossible.
Yeah, almost impossible, yeah. Well, life really is impossible. I'll leave you with that thought. However, there is cake and whatnot to eat, right? So I think that should cheer you up. So I want to thank Amy and Catherine and Michelle for doing all this and providing a place for all you folks to be miserable and question everything. So I had a ball. And I hope to see you all again, here or somewhere else. Please, everybody, please, please take care of yourselves and especially one another. That's the thing. So I'll talk to you later at the coffee table or whatever table that is. Bye.